18th, Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. Today we're hearing, we have a public hearing, House Bill 5044, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and we have Dennis Johnson, Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Vicki Merkel, Director of Scholarship and Access Programs, also of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and Bill McGee from DAS Budget Management Division. And just to make clear, I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 5044. And before we launch into the discussion from the Student Assistance Commission, Steve Bender from LFO is going to explain what is sitting on our desk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good afternoon. There are a number of items on your desk this afternoon. The first is an item that I put together that comes from the Student Assistance Commission's documents. They produced this, but it starts with a table that shows the Oregon Opportunity Grant income limits proposed for next year, 07-08. As you recall, under the governor's budget for the first year of the biennium, which would be 07-08, the existing Opportunity Grant program would be continued, and for 08-09, this would be the shared responsibility model will be implemented. But what this shows is basically to give you an idea of how much money you can make and still be eligible for opportunity grants under the current system. As you can see, the amount, the maximum income depends upon whether you're dependent on your parent or guardian or whether you're an independent student, and it varies by the size of your household. But once you qualify, the amount that you receive is independent of your income and your household size. So, for example, and if you want to look at the amounts that you get, if you go to the second page, you can see the amount of the opportunity grant that you get. Even though this has a number of different items on this, a number of different institutions on this table, most of the opportunity grant recipients fall into one of the first two rows, because all community college students who qualify as full-time students receive the amounts you see there. If you qualify as a half-time student, you receive half of these dollar amounts. Oregon University System students receive the amounts that you see on the second row, and for OHSU and all of the private institutions, the amounts vary by institution, whereas they are the same for all community colleges and all OUS schools. For the independent institutions, some of the numbers become quite, you know, large. If you look, for example, Reed College has the highest opportunity grant award amounts. Students next year at Reed College who receive the grant would receive just short of $5,000 from the state. But again, if you flip back to the first page, I ask you to look at one particular number. This would be for independent students who are living on their own. So you can see there that if you have an income of $9,600 or less, you will qualify for the amounts on the second page. If you have an income above that, even if it's $9,610, you'd qualify for zero. And you heard yesterday some students saying they missed the cutoff by $30 or what have you. The final page shows some projected amounts for students under the shared responsibility model. These are not all of the tables that have been produced, but these are just some of them. And what I'd like to refer to right now is the second row of tables where it says independent student, unmarried, no dependents. This is the person who is equivalent to the independent one who had a cutoff of $9,600. As you can see, if you approve the shared responsibility model for this type of student, they would qualify for amounts up to incomes within the range of $30,000 to $3,500. So there would be a much larger extension. And the award amounts, instead of being what you see on the second page, would tend to be substantially higher, and furthermore would vary by the student's income. They would not be independent of the student's income. So that's just doing some information on the Opportunity Grant Program and the Shared Responsibility Model. The other two items that have been distributed to you were both distributed by the commission today. One is an update of what they plan to talk about today. This is the final day of their public hearing. Starting tomorrow, you'll be starting on the Oregon Department of Education. And the second page is a little bit more information on policy option package 101, which I believe they're going to be starting with. Are there any questions or comments?
No, great. Thank you very much. Right, Mr. Johnson, looks like you're going to lead us off.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As Mr. Bender said, the white sheet, and it is in a plastic sleeve for most of you. My thinking was you'd be referring back and forth in your binders, but at least this sheet would be one that you could keep handy. That's where we start. And we left off just before we got into Roman numeral 2 on this island, on this outline here, talking about targeted programs. But I'd like to finish up a little bit more on the shared responsibility model based on some of the information that we discussed yesterday. And hence the blue sheet, which does clarify that policy option package a little bit more. This shows that as Margie Lyle from the governor's staff outlined yesterday, implementing the new shared responsibility model is an additional cost of about $650,000. This, you have much more detail in your binder. You can see how we come up with those individual amounts and more detail than you probably want to get into today. But I wanted to clarify for you that the application process stays the same. The disbursement process stays the same. It is in determining the student award amounts, the individual award amounts that Mr. Bender outlined. That's where the expense comes in. Building the new computer system, making sure that all of the programming works, that everything is correct, that's where the expense is. So this fleshes that out a bit more than what we had given you earlier. Then back to the outline. If there are any questions, I can stop at any point, but I wanted to get right into the other policy packages, and they're not in numerical order per se, but they are in order of what should appear in your binder. We have a package to change the Jobs Plus program only in the sense that unutilized funds would be transferred from DHS to the commission, and that would happen to allow us to use those funds for a scholarship for Jobs Plus former participants. The idea is that we make use of the money that often gets reverted to the general fund. It, by statute right now, would go into the opportunity grant at the end of each biennium. And our rationale for this is that these are students we've been finding through the marketing work that we do with...
Excuse me, Mr. Johnson, can you help us out?
Yes,
it is the third tab in the binder. And third tab, the one that says scholarship grants?
Yes, right. And then it is the Jobs Plus package. How far in are we?
It's another page again. I don't see the number.
It's about... About halfway in.
About 10 pages. But as I said, they are out of order, and I apologize for that. The idea here is to improve the program by utilizing the funds so that they can be used for similar participants, similar students. Right now, these funds that the employers and the students have contributed revert to the general fund if unused.
Mr. Chair, I'm shuffling favor here. I might ask a question. What's the corpus of that fund? What was the transfer?
It is approximately $1.5 million. The last transfer that was made was about $320,000 a few years ago. So it has grown again, and in the past, as much as $2 million has been reverted to the general fund or used for other purposes rather than going for the students who paid in those funds to their individual education accounts. The next one, and I'm hoping it's not too far out of order here, is package 108. You heard testimony yesterday from Scott Eckblad from the Office of Rural Health in support of this. This is expanding the existing program. Awards candidates who have contracts to practice in qualifying sites. And the
we go from 104 to 109.
And then it's like about five more pages on. It's about five more pages on.
Past 109.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I'm
okay.
Sorry. Past 109. They are out of order. The program was expanded recently to include dentists. It includes other health professionals, of course, and this is for practitioners in the field. They must have a contract to practice in that rural community. We have a selection process, professionals who help us to select from among the best candidates. The expansion, then, of general funds would enable us to award more students.
Representative Ward.
So the total funding to this is just over $23,000?
No, the $23,000 is to add staffing to help us do this. We have that is the only administrative cost, and that is a fraction of an FTE over the biennium. The actual general fund expansion is $600,000 for awards to practitioners.
How come, may I ask another question? Why do you need another quarter of a person?
This is one of those very labor-intensive programs. Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I apologize for a lack of explanation here, but the program does not currently have administrative support to do this, and when we add more practitioners, more work with the selection committees, we take time away from other programs. These small programs, relatively small compared to the rest of the agency, can end up taking a lot of staff time. The ratio, as Mr. Eckblad mentioned yesterday, can be as small as between 2 and 13 recipients out of 300 or so applicants. So there's a lot of work to do to get to the point of helping that small number.
So there isn't going to be any more, and I'm just trying to get a feel for this, but are we adding to the amount that is going to be going out to people that get the awards? There's additional funding there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, yes, that is the $600,000 increase in general fund appropriation.
And also, excuse me, Steve Bender has some information that will be helpful.
Mr. Chair, members, if you still have this set of charts that I distributed the first day, well, part of the last page there's a table that shows some of the impacts of these packages that we're talking about today. The one that Mr. Johnson is talking about now is the Rural Health Services Program. The line there shows the amount that would actually be available for loan repayments. It doesn't include the amount for agency operations, but you can see it's an increase of about $440,000 this biennium to over $1 million next biennium.
Thank you. I get the picture.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with one more apology, now we have to go back about nine pages to student child care, and explain that one. This is an interagency agreement with the Department of Human Services that is a result of negotiation over time, study with relevant constituents ranging from students who are themselves parents and users of this grant to providers of child care. And the feeling is that OSAC, our agency, Because we work primarily with students, that we have a unique role to play as advocates for their needs. And in this case, there's no increase to the general fund. It's simply a transfer of the program, which would occur at some point into the new biennium. We're estimating perhaps as soon as October of 2007. Hence, the $1 million amount for the biennium would be less for us. You'll see a lower amount in the budget projections there. But the amount would enable us to set up this program and use our existing disbursement system, select recipients, award the students, and disperse the funds through the college and university financial aid offices, the way we do all of our other scholarships and grants through electronic transfers. The students tell us, and this is the Oregon Student Association, the OSA, you heard from some of their members yesterday in their testimony, they tell us they would like an advocate, somebody working with them on this program. This is a small program that tends to get lost, they say, in the DHS bureaucracy. We certainly support anything that helps students, and these are students with special needs.
Okay, Representative Morgan?
So is this a change in the size of the grants or anything around the program other than the fact that instead of making payments to the providers, the payments go to the students?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I suspect that the amounts of the grants will become more standardized. Right now they vary by the number of hours of child care needed. Certainly we will continue to pay at different levels for different types of child care. Infant care is much more expensive than older children, for example. We will use an advisory group with representatives from all of the constituencies that I mentioned, have a process in place that helps us to evaluate the need of the students. I suspect that, like DHS, we will find a very long waiting list of students, but the award amounts are apt to become more standardized as we go along, perhaps a more of a set dollar amount for a term, a quarter, or semester that the student is involved, rather than the amounts varying dramatically by the month, which is the way it is quite frequently now for recipients of the grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a similar question and also another one. What would be the qualifying criteria for selecting recipients? Will they have to be already recipients of a shared responsibility grant, or can they be outside the program but still need child care?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, we expect that the eligibility criteria that will be set up will take into account the overall student financial need. Needier students will be getting larger shared responsibility model opportunity grants, of course. They will also qualify for other forms of assistance. One of the benefits of this program is that we work very closely with all of the college and university financial aid offices at all of the schools on that list you just saw. For a student to get this kind of grant, the financial aid director will have to go into their record-keeping system, increase the student budget by the amount that is expected to be needed for child care, and then this grant will offset that. It will not change the amount of the shared responsibility model opportunity grant. That is set through an entirely different system. Now, we will be evaluating the students based on their overall financial need. So the ones who have several dependents and are trying to attend, imagine, if you will, a single parent with two dependents, that's a little bit needier than a single independent student with one dependent. So we would have a waiting process to ensure that we're meeting the needs first of the needy students.
Mr. Chair, follow up. So just quickly then, to recap, the amount of the award will depend in part on the number of dependents and the going rate for child care in that area. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Morgan.
Again, just for personal clarification, if you have a student that has two children and is the sole responsibility for financially for those kids, is that financial financial responsibility considered when you set the levels for opportunity grants? And is that part of the financing discussion that takes place when you analyze that student's needs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, it is in the sense that the size of the family and the number in college determine the amount of the student's overall financial aid budget on the college or university campus. So it is certainly taken into account there. The added expenses for child care usually are not. They will not be in a standardized budget for the shared responsibility model opportunity grant. They would not be in a standardized budget on campus. So these are things that we would add in and then have an offsetting grant from this program if this transfer is made.
May I ask one more question?
Question.
So with the amount of money here, which is not a lot of money, do you have any idea, and I would imagine the answer is no because you haven't yet received the program, about how much, what the unmet need is? I mean, we hear often anecdotally from students that child care is a huge barrier to access to the process, and that they often, that is a big financial burden for them. And so I'm wondering if there has been any work done on what the unmet need is there financially.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, that's a very fundamental question. The unmet need would be the amount if we were to take all of the students who could potentially have their financial aid budgets, their campus budgets, expanded to include the child care. How much of it can be met by this program? A very small fraction, 120 to perhaps 200 students at the most, you know, help through this. Right now, DHS has a waiting list far into the four figures, over 1,000. So we know there's a lot of need. Now, on the flip side of that, larger opportunity grants will help these students, and it will help them in not just paying for their direct educational expenses, but also for their living expenses. So we will help, but of course we could demonstrate on paper that there will continue to be a lot of unmet need.
Thank you.
Yesterday.
Please proceed.
Each of these programs has behind it, and you find them out of order, but in different, in this section, you find the performance measures in different categories. In Jobs Plus, we would be measuring how much we can leverage these funds for other financial aid funds. What other assistance will we be able to get for the recipients of Jobs Plus grants, or this Jobs Plus scholarship program that we would be creating. Rural health care has an example, and I wish we had more time. We have not been able to work with the Office of Rural Health, but if you think about what Mr. Ekblad said yesterday, anywhere from 2 to 13 candidates being selected out of a pool of 300 or so. Well, we would hope with expanded funding that we would then be able to help more recipients. This is a different kind of program. We're not helping students to attend college or university for a first degree. We're helping them to become practitioners in rural areas. So we would want to then measure a different kind of thing. Not did they complete or at what rate, but how many have we been able to place, how many rural communities if we've been able to help. In the student child care area, this is that simple ABC form. We're comparing in each of these cases the program as it exists to what other performance measures we have. In the case of student health care, DHS recommended to us some measures that aren't as relevant for students as they would be for their agency. As you can imagine, In the DHS context, it's very relevant that someone using child care not have to switch providers several times during a year. So they would want to measure that. Well, we could measure that, but that's not as relevant to us as maybe measuring the persistence and completion rates of students who get these grants. That's what we do with our other programs anyway. We want to find out, do these programs help students to stay in school? Do they help them to graduate and become successful? And we can measure completion rates, generally accepted measures for other programs that we have. A two-year program, we're looking at about 150% of that time. How many complete that two-year program within 3 years? Four-year degree, how many complete within 6 years? So persistence, completion, again, more relevant for this kind of program than for the others. So while we haven't made formal proposals of these, and in some cases are very small and we would not recommend separate measures for a small program, these are things that we certainly intend to track. We do that. We gather the data. We take very seriously the requirement to be accountable in each case. So they're different for the different programs, but there will be measures, and the data will be available, and we will be reporting. If there are no other questions on these programs right now, what I'd like to do is transfer the presentation here for the next while to Vicki Merkel, who is our Director of Scholarship and Access Programs. It is one of our great joys to talk about the success stories in Aspire. It's one of our challenges to talk about where we intend to take this program that started as a very small private program 8 years or so ago, privately funded pilot program. Now we're in 82 high schools. How do you take a program like this statewide? Vicki Merkel will explain that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Vicki Merkel, Scholarship and Access Programs Director, and I will be working in tab 4, labeled Access, and I promise to go in order of pages here. The first two pages are an overview of the Aspire program, and if I may assume that you're familiar with the program, I will skip to the third page, which is the map of Aspire, and where we are currently, the schools that have applied and competed at this point. All of these services are being provided by other funds, both private foundation dollars and several federal grant dollars that help us implement the program into the various schools. As our executive director just said, we started 8 years ago with only four schools. The first three years of this program were a pilot program. It was a joint initiative with the Oregon Community Foundation, and we focused on, could we develop a program that was replicable throughout the state. So we chose rural, urban schools of varying sizes, and we worked very hard to build a program that you can drop in any location and at any type of school, including alternative schools and homeschools, and have it work. The next chart shows you how we anticipate the program growing with if the governor's budget is approved to move the program up to 150 schools from the current 82. So that includes the 82 that are served and moving up to 150 over the next biennium. And the next chart shows you the number of volunteers. And I do want to speak just for a moment about the volunteers who participate, because I think we focus on the program design and the students, but what we're really doing at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission is we've built the framework, and it's like a big machine, and inside that machine are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of volunteers out in the communities. We have over almost nearly 1,000 volunteers last year, which is a lot of people to be giving to the state of Oregon. You can see on the slide labeled volunteerism proven cost effective that the cost goes down for the next biennium because the program design changes. We looked at what it would take to continue our current program design, and we would have had to add many, many more staff. So I think we've been very creative, and I'll speak to that when I talk about the program option package.
Ms. Merkel, before you go forward, can I take you back a little bit? On the page that says Aspire Reaching Oregon Students that has the number of students served, that one. What happened between 03-05 and 05-07? That's a huge jump.
It's a huge jump, mainly due to the increase in number of schools served, because we were, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission was awarded a national AmeriCorps grant, which gave us more members to put in schools. We've learned throughout the program that it takes additional staff at the school.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin.
I think several of us are probably aware. I just don't know if the entire committee is aware of how AmeriCorps works in terms of the number of people that you might have and the fact of how little cost it is to you. I wish she could cover that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the AmeriCorps program, there's actually two components that you can compete for, two types of programs. One is a national grant, which is a larger grant giving you more members. The other is a state grant, which has fewer members. The members are paid a stipend similar to Peace Corps or VISTA, and they receive a very, they actually frankly pledge a year of poverty. They receive a very small stipend. If they work full time, we provide them with health care, but not part-time. We've tended to, in our program, used a mix of both full-time and part-time members. Our full-time members are probably our more traditional AmeriCorps members that you may think of, the recent college graduate who goes off to serve. Our part-time members, however, have come from the community, and we've had members up into their 70s. And this has been a real learning curve for us on what we need to take the program and expand it, is that there are people in their community willing to serve as a coordinators like AmeriCorps, and so we've added a big piece of our program option package. Upon completion of their service, and they sign a contract with the federal government to serve, upon completion of their year of service, they are awarded a small educational award that they can either use to pay back loans or for further schooling, so that's an incentive to complete, as well as the contract.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Volunteers creating a community investment. I think one of the important pieces that we don't want to lose as we move forward in expanding the program, hopefully, is the community investment. This is a grassroots design program. I've had many years of experience working in social services developing local community service delivery systems. And without local buy-in, it's very difficult to sustain a program. When you're counting on volunteers as your service delivery system, those are community members who really need to feel ownership of the program. We've maintained this grassroots buy-in by recommending that the special payments money in our program option package that will fund the on-site coordinators only fund 50% of the cost with the general funds, and the other 50% be raised locally. And again, we know we can do this because we've been doing it with that AmeriCorps grant. For those member stipends and some of our administrative costs, we've been charging the schools, and they've been able to pay. There are a few schools who have trouble, and there we have had our private foundation partners actually give us a small pot of money that we can help those schools, and we're encouraging those partnerships to do so. We don't want to lose those you know, schools that are really having a hard time in low-income communities. But I think it's very important to continue this sense that the program belongs to the local community. One of the things that we also found as we developed the program, initially we thought of it as a mentoring-only program, and we discovered that once Aspire hits the school, so to speak, there are lots of services that start to happen regarding post-secondary access information. Suddenly there's information in newsletters, there are announcements in the middle of football games about this new Aspire program and how you get involved. We find that sometimes the middle schools come over and get information. So we started to track non-mentored students as well. A little piece of those non-mentored students are what we call tag-along students, the student who doesn't sign up for a mentor but joins their best friend to come along, and a good Aspire advisor will give information to those students as well. This page explains some of our other outreach efforts in addition to Aspire that we do in our programs. College Gold Sunday is a Lumina Foundation grant. We're number 38 of the states to join this statewide effort to bring financial aid direct assistance on one day in Oregon where students and their families could attend an event and have a professional help them with a worksheet and then go to the computer and actually file their FAFSA, which is, as you know, is also the application for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Policy package 102, actually, it's not the policy option package that recognizes aspiring state statute. That would be House Bill 2729. But what we've asked for and what is in the governor's budget, again, is to expand Aspire to 150 schools. Schools would continue to apply and compete for Aspire. We do that, part of that, the reasoning for that application process is so that we can evaluate the school's readiness to succeed with a volunteer program. One of the things that I found out very early on is that high schools are not always accustomed to having volunteers in the building. If some of you are parents, you know that when your child is in elementary school, there's lots of opportunities to volunteer. You're asked to come in and grade papers, go on field trips, all sorts of things. When your child hits middle school, if you don't tell them, you might be able to chaperone the class dance. But you can't, you know, don't let them know ahead of time. And by high school, you're lucky if you can drop them off, you know, within two blocks of a high school. So,
sorry. Mr. Chair, we're all laughing about this because those of us who've raised children have gone through this experience. And in fact, I just have to share a quick story. In middle school, when my kids were in middle school, I told the principal that it would work better if the sixth grade parents could chaperone the eighth graders and vice versa, so that you weren't chaperoning your own children's class. And it worked out really well. But you're exactly right. I mean, the volunteers just sort of disappear as the children grow older, and that's why this program is so darn important.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. And so in our program design, we've had to actually help school administrators understand how to welcome those volunteers into the building and how to keep them coming back. And when we get an evaluation, that's one of the things we look for. Are you used to working with volunteers? What plans do you have? And those sorts of things. The program option package, as I mentioned, the largest single chunk of money is for special payments for 50% of general funds to fund an Aspire site coordinator. That would be that AmeriCorps-like person, and I frankly believe this is our last three-year grant for AmeriCorps. AmeriCorps is very proud of this program. It's considered a national model. They've been funding it for about 9 years, and we had to do a lot of really, you know, convincing, fast-talking at the last grant review process, saying that we did have interest from this governor in the state stepping forward and supporting the program with general funds. The current staff positions will adjust with more of a focus on training the trainers. We'll be working with the school staff. The Aspire regional positions will refocus on looking at outcomes evaluation data that's collected from the schools, which I'm very excited about. We'll actually build it into the school agreement or contract with OSEC that they'll be required to collect specific data. And those staff will also provide technical assistance. And then we have a position that you can read about in depth in the Orbitz budget narrative that will upgrade our training and development materials to, they're good now, but they could be better. One of the things we found out early that was a myth is that the schools do not always have information on post-secondary access and financial aid. I was so surprised. I thought the counselors would have all of that information. Some do and do it very well, but it's not necessarily a piece of information that's covered in their training, or even if they were trained, that they necessarily have time to deliver. So we really feel that we can beef that up. The performance measure is the last page, and I do, this is the ABC form. We don't currently have a key performance measure on Aspire. for the last, since 1998, we have been measuring, as I said, the first 3 years we measured the pilot program. What is this, how is this program delivery system work in different types of schools or communities? And then every year we have been collecting a lot of outputs data. We have surveyed all of the student participants who would fill out the form. Again, these are high school students, volunteers, and the site coordinators. So we have a wealth of data. And the last evaluation that was completed by a student, I've had two interns, was the 203 evaluation, I believe. Where we need to go and where I recommend that we develop a key performance measure is really looking at outcomes. I think we are all ready to know what specifically happens to a student after participating in Aspire. One of our primary partners were talking about having them fund an independent evaluator for this program and focus on things such as the number of Aspire participants who apply for financial aid and the number of those attending after a post-secondary high school graduation. And then thirdly, I would also like to see those who complete. That takes a long time. That's a six-year waiting period to see if they complete. But very excited that we now have a national student clearinghouse, that if we have a student's Social Security number for a very small cost, we can input that that data point and find out what schools they did attend and did they complete. This may take some coordination with the Oregon Department of Education and Oregon University systems, but we do look forward to developing a key performance measure for this program.
And I think also Steve Bender had some additional information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out a couple things about this package that may not have been entirely clear, and that is that this, of course, is a program that's operated for some time entirely on donations and grants. The AmeriCorps is one of the grant sources. The governor's budget is proposing about $1.35 million in general fund for this program. Approximately half of that would go to the high schools, as Ms. Merkel was mentioning, to finance volunteer coordinators there. The other half would be used for agency administration, and it would include an increase of approximately five positions at the agency to administer this, not five full-time positions. Some of them would be existing positions that would be expanded. But this, I just wanted to put some of these items, make sure you understand.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I noticed the local funding sources include sort of machines. Do you have any sense of how much we're depending on soda pop and sugar for funding these folks?
Chair DeLisio, members of the committee, I should probably change that to beverages now. I think many schools have not put in sugary beverages. These are some of the small rural schools that, you know, this is where a parent group might have control over those beverage machines and choose to donate the proceeds from that. It doesn't happen very often. I included that to show the creativity of some of the schools and how much they want this program and they're willing to do to raise that local match.
It's government funding our schools by bake sale, Mr. Chair. That's what we've been doing for the last 15 years.
Representative Morgan.
What is the value of the Aspire grant from the federal government?
I actually have those figures in the handout if you'd like.
Okay. Well, speaking from the timber industry, I'm in favor of using the paper we can.
And members of the committee. This chart reflects the private foundation dollars and the grants that Aspire has used for the last biennium. And I should mention that in the figures that the agency submitted, we also included any continuation grants that have been deducted from the need for general fund for staffing. You can see that the first sum total is for Aspire only. Not every school has an AmeriCorps member, and I probably didn't make that clear. We don't have enough AmeriCorps members for every school. Some schools don't need one. They may have a school-to-work coordinator who would love to take this on, or they have that wonderful community volunteer who's on a mission to make sure that Aspire happens in that school. And then the AmeriCorps grant, I did separate out because it is such a large chunk of money, and most of those funds do go towards paying for the stipend and the benefits for the AmeriCorps member. And you can see the grant size difference for the subtotal AmeriCorps. That's the difference between the national level grant and the state grant.
Representative Ward.
So I believe that you said that getting the AmeriCorps funding more than just this time is going to be extremely challenging, and it didn't sound like it was something that we'd want to bank on.
Representative Galizia, members of the committee, we are entering, we're in our first year of a three-year grant. AmeriCorps issues grants on a cycles of 3 years here in the state. And we are completing with the 06-07, our first year. We're preparing our continuation grant materials. We've done well. I don't expect to lose that grant for years two and three. But to compete for a brand new grant in at the beginning of the next biennium, 09-11, that sounds so strange to say, I think will be quite a challenge. I think we're experiencing fatigue. Our former Aspire program manager submitted 13 grants in order to match the Ford Family Foundation challenge grant for a central region supervisor, and we got no takers. We're not a new program anymore. We're not a pilot program. We're just not getting that kind of activity. We're very grateful for the Ford Family Foundation and the Oregon Community Foundation, who really have stuck with this program and see its value, not only for helping students, but also for bringing students to their scholarship programs.
Well, and my questions are around the sustainability of this, that I'm sure that you must have had discussions. If there is this infusion of general fund revenue and the program is enlarged, but the funding at the base of it is eroding, where does that leave us? I mean, are we expecting that the grant funds are going to continue? Do we have reason to believe that they will?
Representative Morgan, I get confused. When building the agency request budget, we took the known grants into account and built them in. The Ford Family Foundation, for example, is also a three-year grant that will continue through the next biennium.
Okay.
We built those in. The Oregon Community Foundation grant from their education committee, we think that if that's the partner who would like to help us with the evaluation, they may redirect those funds to the evaluation. So we try to be very thoughtful in how our funding partners will continue with Aspire. The Gear Up grant is one that will end. It's a federal grant. It is originally awarded for 5 years. Because of the cohort they work with, they may extend for a sixth year. It's federal math. They actually end the cohort group when they're juniors in high school, and they finally need to add the sixth year to get. So that one we know will go away. So I think the answer to your question.
On the Gear Up grant, that's a five-year grant, and which year of it are we in right now?
The fifth year.
The fifth year? So
yes.
It's going to go away.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it may extend for one more year. We won't know till next summer when the federal budget is approved.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Morgan's questions, what's your first best guess then in terms of the state's responsibility for the 09-011 biennium? Assuming we keep the program, we flat fund the program at its new level.
I'm not sure. I'm Representative Galizia, members of the committee. I mean, the best guess for the amount of private dollars that would go away?
Yes.
Or
and or the reverse, what would the state be responsible for, provided that some of these dollars disappear in the interim?
It would be...
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I think we could assume, first of all, that in 2009-11 we won't have the AmeriCorps grant any longer, and that would leave a gap of 300,000, 245 of which we use for staffing right now. The rest of it is the match that the school systems provide, but you're looking at a gap of 200,000 to 300,000 in that area. Some of the others perhaps could be replaced from other sources. We can't speak for our partners in the Ford Family Foundation or the Oregon Community Foundation. They know that we're very aggressive about asking, and they're used to hearing from us. But I think we have to assume that these federal funds are going to dry up. As Ms. Merkel mentioned earlier, the AmeriCorps program just isn't used for long-term sustainability. It is designed to get programs started, and then they move on to other areas. So we're fortunate to have to be in the first year of a three-year state grant. We think it will be continued for the next biennium, but that would leave a, anywhere you look at it, a quarter of a $1 million hole in the funding for the 09-11 biennium.
Per year?
That is per year. So it would be $500,000 for that biennium. That's right.
So if I'm getting what you're saying, there are in the 09-11 biennium significant roll-up costs to this program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, to sustain the program at the level of 150 schools, yes, there would be. If you were to continue to want to have a site coordinator in every school, it is possible, as I said before, the program's quite flexible. We think that you'll see more growth and sustainability with a site coordinator, but you could choose to make the program or that particular piece of the program available to every school.
Well, and I'm not trying to be doom and gloom here. I'm just trying to get a realistic look at where we're going to be ending up here in the next biennium, or the one following the one we're working on now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, as Ms. Merkel said, the program is scalable to a certain extent, and one of the things that we put into this phase two, as we call it, of development, the trainer kind of aspect, the standardization of the curriculum, we don't really know how many schools out there across the state can fund the entire cost of a site coordinator. We know that some of the low-income schools or schools in low-income communities have a great deal of difficulty with that amount now. There are some who would not need the assistance of this program to do that. That's what's untested right now. We have met the needs of the neediest schools, so that's what we are doing right now. But we do feel that it can be scalable with the staff in place, the outreach, the people traveling out to the schools, training the trainers, training the site coordinators, so that they're, you know, this culture of mentoring gets established. It's not the same in each community, so we'll learn more, but I don't think it is the kind of situation where we would be starting a program and then having to shrink it in 2 years because the resources went away. We would, I think, get very, very creative if we knew we didn't have AmeriCorps, if we knew the funding were going to be level. We would get creative about ways of staffing those schools.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Sam, again, I'm not tracking the numbers. Steve, maybe you can help us. I see general fund of $1.8 million and then $1.1 million looks like a credit, $305,000 other funds. And then when I look at the summary on the back, I don't see anything that resembles either of those two numbers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, the eventual funding that was approved for this program in the governor's recommended budget totals $1,351,309 in general fund. I know it's hard to find it in that particular material, but that is the amount that is in the budget for this particular program. There's also an offsetting reduction of other funds reflecting the phase-out of some of these AmeriCorps grants that had been approved or available in 2005-07. So the net increase in funding is $1.1 million, but it requires $1.35 million in general fund to provide that. This particular information, if you want to see it more clearly, the place that I see it is in the other binder, the governor's recommended budget binder on page 107. That has a table that shows very clearly what each of the policy option package costs are in terms of general fund and other funds. And this is package 102 in that table on page 107.
Just to follow up on the numbers that we have here, the 1.8 and 1.1 are...
I believe these were the original requests to the governor. The governor did not fund this particular package at the level that the agency had originally requested.
Okay, well, I'll clarify that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you done?
Yeah,
okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to... bring up another colleague here to talk about the Office of Degree Authorization. For this particular section, we need to refer directly to your binder. There won't be an overhead or a slide, but the first page in that would be, where are we? Section 5. And Alan Contreras.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alan Contreras, Administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. The office does three main things, and the funding for those things is different, so I'll just briefly describe how that works. The three things we do are evaluate and approve academic degree programs from certain kinds of schools in Oregon. We deal with diploma mills, a wide variety of evaluative work related to to college degrees. And then we also handle, on an occasional basis, adverse impact cases, which involve conflicts between different sectors of post-secondary education about who gets to offer new degrees. The evaluation and approval of degree programs for offering Oregon is entirely other fund. That is funded by applicant fees, and that fee structure is established by the legislature in statute. So that is in here. We are hoping to make a small change in the fee structure this summer. We've only had one fee increase in about 10 years. The fee structure works fairly well. The main thing that has happened with the ODA budget over the last three biennia is that the general fund has, until this time around, until this recommendation, been reduced for several biennia. And what happened in practice is that the agency's loan guarantee program, which no longer exists, had generated enough revenue that the other functions that we did, in effect, part of my position, really, was covered by that. Well, that program went away 2 years ago, as many of you may recall. And so what we're trying to do with the governor's recommended budget this year is essentially bring the ODA basic functions back to where they were three biennia ago in terms of what the funding structure looks like. The other addition that we are attempting to make is to add one quarter of a position, the rest of which belongs to some of the other activities in the agency, to expand some of our student consumerism activities, information regarding the loan scams, information regarding degree mills, a lot of outreach to business and that sort of thing, and some improvements to our website where we have recently managed to add an employer's guide to college degrees and how to evaluate them and that sort of thing. So that is the basic structure and the basic funding of ODA and how it works. I don't have a great deal to add to that today. We do have one existing performance measure that has worked fairly well. That has to do with the turnaround time for degree approval applications. commission's regulations ask that we do the turnaround within 6 months. In practice, we have tried to keep that below 4 months, and that has worked fairly well. We've been able to maintain that. The additional performance measure that we are suggesting is that, you know, as we try to expand our public outreach activities, that we use our recently acquired capacity to count web hits on selected portions of our site to see if we are getting more hits and, to some extent, who is looking. Right now, for example, we're able to determine that a lot of state and federal agencies use the site, but it's hard to determine to what extent there's a lot from the private sector. So that's basically ODA and how it works and what the budget structure is like. It's fairly small. There's only two of us right now. So.
Are there any questions or comments? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Over the past several years, we've read in the newspaper about a variety of basically bogus degree programs. On your Crit Facts 2007, you mentioned average major bad degree cases about 10 per year. Is this a major component of the office? Is this something that costs Oregonians a lot of money for something that in fact isn't worth anything? Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
It's always a little hard to distinguish between what constitutes a case and what doesn't. In practice, we get many, many, many inquiries from both the public and private sector. There's an additional sheet in there that shows a 10-month count of roughly what our inquiries look like. We get a lot of people who contact us from state agencies or the federal agencies or a lot from the private sector in Oregon and from colleges trying to find out, is such and such a school accredited or is it not? You know, can its degrees be used in Oregon, and if so, for what? For example, pardon me, there are certain degrees that are legal for use in the state of Oregon, but they carry certain restrictions. They have to be used with a disclaimer of accreditation, or they cannot be used for employment in a licensed profession, that sort of thing. Those I don't count as major cases. That is a fair chunk of my workload is answering a steady stream of that kind of thing. When I say we get about 10 major cases, those are situations in which we have to do a fair amount of investigation into what the school really is, who the person is, are they really in Oregon, are they trying to use the degree in Oregon. Some of these are referrals from other agencies. For example, we work quite a bit with the Board of Nursing, which has us do screenings for degrees that come from outside the state of Oregon. So there's a very wide variety, and the 10 major cases is simply my best estimate of about how many we end up generating a significant file on in a given year. But it doesn't reflect the sort of daily flow of work.
Do you get inquiries from potential students who are saying, I'm thinking about matriculating at, what do you call it, Al's College, Big Al's College, and who want to know whether it's a legitimate operation, and you're able to warn them off or say, yes, indeed, you can go there and expect to get a good education? I mean, how many of those kinds of inquiries do you get?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we get a very large number of that kind of inquiry, not only from students, but from or potential students, but from their parents. I'm hearing more and more from parents who have come across our website and who call and say, my daughter is thinking of going to Big Al's College of the Bayou. Is that a degree that is worth the X dollars she wants to pay for it? Can it be used in the marketplace? Some of these relate to schools that are simply bogus, but others relate to schools that are legitimate but which may be extremely expensive relative to the student's ability to get work in the job market. And that's the kind of question we're seeing more of. And that is the kind of question that we are hoping to do a little better job researching and responding to if we're able to add this one quarter of a position as part of the package throughout the agency. But we are seeing more of that kind of thing.
If I could get one more quick follow-up. So it sounds to me as though your agency really is going to help protect the potential employers who are inquiring, gee, is that person's degree legit? It's going to help potential consumers of education as they try to decide where to go to school and how much to spend, and thereby help raise the overall standards of education in the state. Is that a fair summary of that piece of your job, at least?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, it is.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It must be a challenge, I mean, in this era of so-called distance learning or online education. There's a great article called Digital Diploma Mills, which I'm sure you're aware of. Do you work with the Department of Education or people in higher education or community colleges and share what criteria that you use to decide whether or not coursework or institutions that deliver online programs are valid or legitimate?
Mr. Chair, it's kind of institution by institution. We work a lot with certain institutions. For example, for a period of a couple of years, we handled all of the international degree evaluations for Lynn Benton Community College at their request, and they actually paid us a small fee to do that. There are other schools that have a larger in-house capacity to do that sort of thing. There are some that seem to be paying more attention to these issues than others. Right now, our interaction with the Oregon University System schools and the community colleges is fairly limited. We tend to work a bit more with the private institutions, that's just sort of for historic reasons, I suppose. But we work, there are also certain state agencies, the Nursing Board, the Psychology Board, that we work with a lot on particular kinds of evaluations that are of use to them, or we answer inquiries from them.
Thank you. Senator Devlin?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered how far this sort of misrepresentation is carried, because, I mean, everybody's familiar with the occasional ad that you might see on a cable channel. Everybody's probably familiar with the ads that you see in some magazines for degree programs that in many cases are probably not legitimate. But I seem to remember some cases where there have been, in a sense, bogus accreditation agencies claimed. You know, things that are not actually legitimate and that... Have you seen that in this area? I saw it in some areas and other. So when we were having some discussions with Ed Ritchie, Eastern Interstate, but of people actually claiming accreditation where they don't have accreditation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, this is common. It is increasing. There is actually a book that came out 10 days ago called Accreditation Mills that deals with this topic. I don't even have a copy yet. They're supposed to send me one.
You can get one online.
Huh?
You can get one online.
Last I heard, it was very, very expensive, Mr. Chair. I'm holding out for a freebie from the author since I helped him out with something
there
else.
You go.
But what we are seeing, and fortunately, Oregon law deals with this situation very directly. Oregon law, in effect, defines accreditation in an educational context as meaning that the accreditor has to be a federally recognized accreditor, and you can't claim other kinds of accreditation unless that's what you have. But around the country, this is very definitely a problem. A lot of the degree mills set up their own fake accreditors and do that sort of thing. In fact, we have a bill in Senator Walker's committee where I made a fool of myself this morning at 8 or 9.
I think you, Mr. Contreras, was the other lobbyist now that we know who the culprit was.
We we brought a few too many amendments in there in the last few weeks. But we have a bill, Senate Bill 198, that does refine how the state law deals with this a little bit. But Oregon's actually been pretty much at the head of the pack on this. There used to be only two states that had laws dealing with this kind of problem. There are now 10. So we feel pretty good about that.
Thank you. Thank you.
I am done.
Thank you. Okay. Oh, Senator Morse has a question. I'm sorry.
I'm not done.
Thank you. I just have another member's question. I see we have a prop for an ad of 1.25 FTE, and we currently have 2 FTE. And then I see, looking at the picks, I see 1.35. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I will begin the answer of that question, and I may need to defer to Dennis. One of the changes is, in effect, a change of a position, most of my position, from the sort of temporary other fund support it's had for the last couple of biennia back to general fund. And there's a quarter of a position that is a new position that is attached to ODA, a portion of which belongs to us, a portion of which belongs elsewhere in the agency. Dennis, is that cover that, or do you want to add anything to that?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Senator Morse, we're backfilling. We had a shortage of funds in this area this biennium. We're also replacing that gap. So I'm attempting to look at this a little more holistically, not as the Office of Degree Authorization standalone. We see everything very much in an integrated way. Students are looking to us for help on everything from avoiding scholarship scams to getting assistance from specific private scholarships or getting an opportunity grant. They don't see lines of distinction, and we work very much together as a team. It's a small staff, only 23 of us right now. Having a gap, having an unfunded portion of a position, has been very difficult for us, frankly, this biennium. So what you're seeing is a net increase of 0.25 in the Office of Degree Authorization, and then backfilling where we have lost funds. We don't have any way of coming up with the funds other than coming to you for general funds.
Just as a follow-up, maybe Mr. Bender, you could explain what the PIC numbers are with the 1.35 FTE.
Mr. McGee had it. Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, what you're looking at is the narrative here for Package 103. What you don't see here is the narrative for Package 70, in which there was a reduction of 1.1 FTE because when you calculated the essential budget level for this division, there wasn't enough revenue to fully fund that essential budget level. So Package 70, in effect, reduces the EBL down to the amount of revenue that's available, and Package 103 is a restoration of all but 0.25 of that FTE. I'm not sure if that helps or not. That's the technical part of how the budget is developed, and you don't have both of those package descriptions right here in front of you.
Okay. Thank you.
That's right. Further questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Contreras.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for your patience. We have abbreviated things a great deal because of last week's change in our schedule, but we have some more important things to finish here, and I direct your attention to the Section 6 materials, the sixth tab in your binders, and I hope that is the one that says operations, and I would like to go right into the efficiencies and improvements. We will also be talking about a couple of policy packages here, but there is more complete information, a spreadsheet, and more than you'd ever want to know, perhaps, about these initiatives, but I do want to tell you that in the area of reducing costs, when I came on a little over a year ago, the agency was still looking at whether to purchase off-the-shelf software whether we could find and adapt and afford that kind of purchase, integrated software for the entire agency. It doesn't exist, and if we bought anything off the shelf, it would cost so much to adapt to our peculiar needs. Those 340-some programs that we run, the new programs that we're developing all the time, we did it ourselves over the past year. We continued a conversion that had begun from an old mainframe to a SQL Server environment. Everything we do is now internet-based, web-based delivery of all of our notifications to the colleges and universities. Everything we do, the inquiries, the queries, everything that we run to administer those programs now, the cost savings has been substantial. It would have been anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000 or more to purchase and then specially adapt off-the-shelf software. We're always working to improve our online application processing, reduce dependence on paper. We're now probably this year, I would think we'll go over 70% of our student applicants completing an online application versus using the hard copy. As Ms. Merkel mentioned a few days ago when we were talking about this, we still print our scholarship catalog and the application materials. Those become counseling and teaching tools for us to use when we do our outreach around the state. We've added lots of services for donors and students and campuses, and are attempting to be ever more responsive. Just this afternoon, we have a group of financial aid administrators meeting with staff over at Chemeketa Community College, an advisory group for the opportunity grant as it exists. We're forming a new working group for the new shared responsibility model opportunity grant. It will have representation from each of the higher education sectors. They're excited about working with us on how we can implement this. We've talked about our scholarship services, using up-to-the-minute theories and practice, really the best practices in terms of scholarship selection. That right now involves using non-cognitive variables, using the research that's been done on how to get students who don't just shine on tests and grades, but might have other leadership potential, other potential that our donors want to be able to reward or support. In terms of ensuring accountability, coming up with the data for those performance measures, we have hammered out data exchange agreements with the Oregon University system, with the community college system. Ms. Marco mentioned the data, National Student Clearinghouse, and the data that we can get from them. There's a cost to this, but if you negotiate, and heaven knows we have the volume, so we get volume discounts when we negotiate these things, we have done very, very well with getting the best possible information, tracking students in ways that we couldn't do independently on our own. How many complete, how many persist, that kind of thing. Certainly, you heard yesterday from one of our volunteer researchers who's done some work in Aspire. You heard that we're working with a foundation, one of our partners. We hope to have an evaluation package in place for Aspire. This is all in lieu of state support, doing program evaluation, ensuring that we have the accountability for our donors, for the state of Oregon. And lastly, planning to implement the shared responsibility model. If we are fortunate enough to get the Senate Bill 334 passed, if we are fortunate enough to have financing for this program in the next biennium, we will have to be ready to implement this in January of 2008. Now, I certainly hope that the legislature is able to adjourn before late summer. It's been known to go that long in the past, but if there were to be only a window of 5 to 6 months or so between adjournment and January of 2008, we couldn't possibly implement a model of this complexity in time for those 8 applications which will arrive at our door January of 2008 for the fall of 2008, the second year of the biennium. So we've had to do a lot of planning in advance, hammer out agreements and get people working behind the scenes. We're doing that. We're taking what is now a simulation model working on creating the projection tools, the awarding modules, and the disbursement that the colleges and universities will depend on. So if the money, if the legislation is passed, if the appropriation is available, we'll be ready. The policy packages that are in your binder that I would call your attention to, the last ones are indicated on the screen, but they're in the binder, and that is, first of all, technology life cycle replacement. What we're talking about here is actually being able to replace on a planned, organized basis some of the computer hardware, software that we use so intensively that we count on. We haven't had a plan for being able to replace that on a regular basis, and as you can imagine, with only 20-some staff, we can do a lot of sharing right now, but sooner or later, desktops wear out, servers need to be replaced, we need to plan for that. So this is our attempt to develop that. In terms of facilities and internal audit, there is a magic threshold in state government. When an agency goes over $100 million volume, it's necessary to plan for an internal audit function. We don't have that right now. Certainly, we, even with the governor's recommended budget, won't be a large enough agency to have a full-time internal auditor, but we will want to purchase those services or procure those professional internal audit services. So we're planning for that. In terms of facilities, we'll wait and see. We're okay where we are. If we get more staff, we need a little bit more space, and that doesn't mean that we wouldn't have to do something different in the next biennium, but right now we've proposed, we will wait and see if we need to change anything in our facilities. And that's it. I did not expect to finish by 4:24 or so.
That is quite all right.
Talk very fast and not get through half the material in the binder. But,
no, no, no.
I thank you.
Kudos to you. So are there any questions or comments?
I compliment you on looking at your list of efficiencies.
Thank you.
It looks like you have a high level of commitment to finding ways to do things better, and we'd like to compliment you for that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, there's one more person who should be thanked. I started in January of 2006, and the agency had already been downsized from a larger agency to a small group, returning to its core mission of really working with scholarships and grants for students, targeted programs, that kind of thing. But I could not have survived the past year if I weren't building on a very firm foundation left me by the previous interim executive director. I think she's in the room, Margie Lau, now with the governor's staff. She left everything in very good shape and made it very possible for me to pick up where she left off and do what you've seen over the last few days.
Thank you, Senator. All right, well, Mr. Johnson and Ms. Merkel and Mr. Contreras and Ms. Lau, thank you all very much. Mr. McGee, thank you all very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5044 and the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education is adjourned.